Related.
I'm Randy Cohen with Person, Place, Thing. Here's a thing, an edger, that overly fastidious tool used to create a more perfect lawn, the physical embodiment of suburban conformity and some kind of OCD. Consisting of a serrated circular blade at the end of a long pole, the edger was rolled along the narrow gap between the lawn and the sidewalk, chopping off the ends of every blade of grass that dared intrude upon the purity of the pavement. Surely anyone determined to undertake such a task was a candidate for therapy. When I was a kid, this deranged chore fell to me, a parentally imposed duty, not a personal obsession. The edger is only one of the evil implements of the suburban lawn. So thirsty for water, so hungry for toxic chemicals. There's the gasoline-burning lawnmower, and that satanic contraption, the leaf blower, destroyer of quiet, destroyer of nerves. The lawn is an expanse of green, but not green in the environmental sense, and certainly not in the moral sense. You might as well install a lead smelter in your yard.
I know I'll make it to Border Radio one day, that my guitar will ring out the Ohio way.
I like to approach my guests obliquely, not talking directly about them, but about a person, a place, and a thing of their choosing. This time that guest is Gernot Wagner, a climate economist at Columbia University. We spoke at the New York Historical Society's Climate Cafe about his person, Martin Weitzman.
So September 17th, 1998, a Thursday, freshman year in college, I want to be a climate economist. I think I want to be a climate economist. I don't know what a climate economist does or what a climate economist is. And Marty Weitzman was a climate economist. So I went to his office hours. And usually, you know, as an 18-year-old, right, you show up to a Harvard professor's office hours, and they sort of tell you, you know, stay in school, don't do drugs, and come back in a couple years once you've taken some economics. He actually sat me down and gave me a yellow legal pad, a number two pencil, and he had the same in front of him, and he sort of walked through his most famous contribution to climate economics, how to solve climate change, how do you tax carbon, how do you limit carbon, and so on. And he sort of explained it to me, not just as, hey, look, you don't understand this quite yet, but trust me, this is important. He walked me through, like, you know, I was his own son, 18-year-old.
But if you were his son and that's what he spent his time talking about, you'd really get sick of it, wouldn't you?
Fair enough, right, yes. Right. I have talked to his daughter since, and yes, there's a bit of that.
Yeah. What is a climate economist?
Well, a living, breathing oxymoron, right? So you either care about the economy, right? Jobs and, you know, interest rates in China and so on, or you care about birds and bees. You don't do both. Or at least, frankly, you know, I've been doing this now for 20 years, I guess. And the first 10 of that, yeah, that was the first thing you heard. It was, wait, pick your side, right? You're either pro-business or you are, you know, you care about the planet. Well, turns out, yeah, the problem is that we are not doing the right thing. We are guiding things in the wrong direction. Well, the solution is re-guiding, re-channeling those market forces, and that's exactly what climate economics is supposed to be doing.
Can you explain also, one of the things I read up about Marty Weitzman, because, yeah, you know, the significance of low probability but catastrophic events.
Oh, it's basically this idea that, look, what we know is bad enough about climate change. What we don't know, these tiny probability, high impact events, is what's going to come back to bite us. And if you take that seriously, it sort of turns the entire logic on its head. It's no longer, You know, the average is the means, the medians, the most likely is what matters the most. It's actually the least likely scenarios that have a high impact that are actually, you know, defining the final outcome.
So give me an example.
Last time there was as much CO2 in the atmosphere as there is today was over 3 million years ago, Pliocene. Sea levels were 10 to 20, 30 meters higher than they are today. Now, nobody's predicting that that's what's going to happen now, right? You know, we would be underwater here in New York, right? Most of New York would be
I live underwater. On the fifth floor, so it's, you know, you're
exactly,
on your own.
Yes, yeah.
What do I
do? You might want to check where the elevator is being. fair enough. But, right, it's the question of, wait, why are climate scientists not predicting that sort of extreme outcome based on, frankly, the stuff we see out there in the atmosphere right now? And you know, Marty, to his credit, this is sort of, you know, how do you do research, right? He went back and read these hundreds, thousands of pages worth of climate reports, IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These very dense scientific reports. And basically unearthed something that apparently most climate scientists, almost every other climate scientist, missed in this, that it is precisely these low probability events that may actually be much, much worse than what we think is most likely.
Does it drive you nuts? You seem awfully cheerful for someone facing the end of the world with real sophistication.
Well, it's too late for pessimism.
Book title.
That's my next one, yes.
Is it?
It is, yes. Right? And frankly, okay, so my bread and butter is sort of these negative tipping points, right? So these low probability, high impact events. Frankly, what we are in right now is this race between these negative tipping points and the positive ones. There are these, you know, socioeconomic tipping points where basically, look, things are dire, yes, but things are moving much, much faster in the positive direction than, frankly, anyone would have imagined 5-10 years ago. Now, is it fast enough? No. It's a race between these negative and positive tipping points, but frankly, got to work on the positive ones, otherwise, you know, we've lost us already.
When you went into his office, did you really already know as an undergraduate that you wanted to be a climate economist?
So, believe it or not, I applied to exactly one college in this country. Stupidly, I had no idea how to do this, right? I grew up in a small town, Austria, applied to one school across the big pond. And I applied there, okay, one, because that's the one college I knew of, and two, they had this environmental economics program there where you could basically study the environment and economics and, you know, you don't have to do it twice over. You could do it once.
So you did know. You're like a teenager and you're going, one day I am going to be a climate. I wanted to be a cowboy at your age. You're so much smarter than me. It's really disheartening. I may have to ask you to leave. Did you know who Marty Weitzman was before you got to school?
Sort of, yes. I heard the name before. Come on. Every teenager is an environmentalist, right?
I just
never grew up.
He had a very tragic death.
He did. He committed suicide. A year after he lost out on winning the Nobel Prize.
To feel despair for not winning the Nobel Prize, well, that means we're all failed. I mean, he was so accomplished and so admired by his colleagues. This is so unsettling.
I had never seen him quite as nervous as the Friday before Columbus Day, 2018, when the prize was announced. It's a small, you know, at that level, it's a fairly small world. Nobody really knows, of course, but yeah, there were mumblings that, you know, this is the turn, right? This is going to happen. This, you know, it's going to be this year. Then it wasn't. And, you know, I can't say that that was the reason. But yeah. Had he won, things might have turned out very differently, yes.
It's nice to hear your voice again. I've waited all day long, even wrote a song for you. It's strange the way you make me feel. With just a word or two, I'd like to do the same for you.
This is Person, Place, Thing. I'm Randy Cohen talking to Gernot Wagner about his place, a ski slope.
The B-19 ski slope. going from the Stubner Kogel down into the Angertal. I guess the guilty pleasure, or frankly, maybe the reason why I work on climbers, right, is skiing. And I guess it's that particular ski slope because that was for the first time when my now 8 and 10-year-old were roaming free, and, you know, 5 years ago at this point. So yes, proud Austro-American dad having watching the two kids go down an Austrian black slope into the abyss. So, okay, so we lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time. And we were the one family who took the commuter rail out to the final stop to go skiing at Wachusett Mountain every weekend, which is the ski slope going from 2,000 feet down to 1,000 feet. Right? So 1,000 feet. So the Austrian version goes from 2,000 meters down to 1,000 meters. Slightly more challenging. And yeah, this is when you graduate, right? When you go down the Austrian black slope.
But there's a moral problem, is there not?
You mean you live
in New York and you enjoy skiing in Austria.
The ton of CO2, like literally the metric ton of CO2.
Is that what it is?
One, right? Not the whole plane, right? You personally, middle seat, economy class, right?
Right.
One metric ton of CO2. Yeah, there is. And frankly, there's currently no solution, right? Okay, so I justified because, look, my parents live there, so I would want to see them anyways. So you can combine things with the family visit. On the other hand, yes, of course, right? Turns out you can take the commuter rail to go skiing in this country, right? Why fly?
Right. So how do you reconcile it?
Poorly. So I'm a vegetarian. I don't drive. I don't have a driver's license. I've never driven. Mm-hmm. I've only ever lived in cities, so I don't have to. But yeah, you add it all up and, you know, you do all the right things. And then your 10-year-old is a gold member at United Mileage Plus.
I mean, in a theoretical way, this is, we're kind of in Marty Weitzman territory again, aren't we? That you could do a sort of personal, individual version of cap and trade, if there was a way to measure all this. That okay, so you everyone is allotted a certain amount of energy use.
Yep.
Right. And then we start checking off what you use. So if you drive X number of miles, well, that costs you big time. If you eat meat, that costs you. If you decide to heat your home in the winter, instead of I never do. I just wear a lot of sweaters. But that costs you. Because you lead a very frugal life, you could decide to use your energy credits to fly to ski, and that would be fine. No?
Well, that's not quite how, right? So one ton of CO2 is a ton of CO2. It doesn't matter how it's generated.
Right.
Right?
So, the
joke, right? So I'm a dual citizen, right? So the average American emits 16, 18, 20 tons of CO2. The average European emits around 10, right? So I get 30. That's not how this works either, right? And by the way, the global average is around 6 or so tons of CO2. So yeah, 6 times across the Atlantic, right? And you are there. Okay, so yes, you know, no car, no meat, no... we live in the city, right? Third floor walk-up, 750 square feet, family of four, right? Get to read about it on the pages of New York Magazine about how we spend too much money to decarbonize the place, right? So, yeah, you do all the right things. And Yeah, twice across the Atlantic, right, is 4 tons of CO2 round trip. And I fly twice across the Atlantic every year.
So, well, if this were posed as a moral question, actions have to be justified on their own, and that because I'm very nice 6 days a week doesn't mean I get to murder a guy on the seventh day because I've done all these offsetting.
Wait, isn't that what Catholicism is all about? Like you show up,
For Jews, I can say.
Yeah, fair enough. Right.
While it's important to do virtuous things and to do things, altruistic things, that is not a license to do forbidden
Absolutely
things.
Absolutely not. Now, okay, now, of course, it shows something much, much bigger, right? So, look, if this were about individual action and only what we do, right, I wouldn't be a climate economist, I would be a priest or a rabbi or something, right? As a climate economist, right? So you know that it's the system that needs to change. And you basically know that it's this interplay of technology on the one hand, individual action, yes, of course, right? You would want to use that. You need to want to use this new technology. And, of course, it's economics and politics and all of the above, right? So for example, right, so one version here is you emit your CO2, you have to ensure that you personally pay for sucking it back out.
Right.
And, yeah, we can do that. It's $1,000 a ton of CO2. So if your round trip, right, is this 1 ton of CO2 emissions, your plane ticket just got $1,000 more expensive. Mm. And actually, I can say for the very first time, I was in Austria for a conference a few months ago. And for the very first time, I told the organizer, look, I'm going to do this, but you have to pay this extra $1,000 to get the CO2 back out and bury it underground. And, you know, reluctantly, but they paid up, and
they did.
Now, okay, does that now give you a license to just fly willy-nilly? No, because, of course, it's still a lot better not to emit it in the first place than to suck it back out. But, yeah, there is a techno fix. It's expensive. Right. And, yes, there are moral implications, too.
Gernot, as part of your point here that the futility, or not the futility, the limitation of individualist actions to what are essentially societal problems?
Yes and no. So, you know, there's the advanced team, right? There is those of us who, yeah, have the money, or at least can get it somehow from the bank, and then can basically demonstrate and say, look, a heat pump is a fundamentally better product than the gas furnace. Yeah, the gas boiler furnace currently costs $3,000-$5,000. The heat pump costs $15,000. It's more expensive. But yes, it's the future. And yes, it takes those of us who can afford it to basically, you know, splurge right now to, you know, take the splurge and basically help climb the learning curve, slide down the cost curve for the rest of us. Because of course, the more of these things we deploy, the cheaper they get.
Right, right. And you're sort of the avant-garde demonstrating for other people, here's a different way to live.
Yes, right. And okay, there too, right? It takes...
So we're putting you on salary for that.
It takes wanting to live a certain way, right? Sort of the 750 square feet loft with, you know, family of four, right? Right? That's not how this works, right? You go out to the burbs, right? You live in Jersey. Because that's where you can get the bedrooms, and by now every kid needs their own bathroom and so on, right? And the bigger the home, the better, right? Now, no, that's not the right thing either. And yes, it takes a certain attitude to want to live that way in the first place.
They say that white light is made up of all other colors of light, and I believe it's true.
This is Person Play Thing. I'm Randy Cohen talking to Gernot Wagner about his thing, a Brompton folding bicycle.
It's a proper bike, and it folds up, and it's sort of the most convenient thing you can imagine in the city. It's carry-on on an airplane or the Acela for that matter, right?
You so, take a lot of flights, don't you?
I do, yes. I can tell you the biking from on the boardwalk in San Diego to the annual meeting of the American Association of Energy and Resource Economists gets you downtown a lot faster than waiting in line for the cab. You stand at Penn Station, you want to get home, lower Manhattan. So a taxi takes 25 minutes in traffic. The train is 25 minutes. Walking, surprisingly, is also around 25 minutes. Mm. Biking is 12.
Right.
And yeah, that's just how you get around.
And it is quiet, so you're not disturbing your neighbors. It is non-polluting. You get a brisk aerobic workout. You're in incredibly great shape. I can see that. I'm glad we're
right
not...
back at you. Yes, yeah, but yeah, so, yeah. Well, you're a biker too, right? Yes,
yes.
Exactly.
I got here tonight on my bike. I mean, it's no big deal. I just live at 94th and West End. Don't call before you come by. but you live in the Village. But that's how I get around town in New York. Bike or the train.
It's just faster, more convenient. Better.
It's morally superior.
Yes, and it is morally superior too.
That to me seems a key point is that people don't will not choose to travel by subway or by bicycle because it's more virtuous. They'll choose their mode of transportation because it's most convenient or most pleasant.
Sure, and turns out, okay, if you live in the city and need to get around in the city, yeah, the most convenient and most pleasant way is by bike and by train.
Right, and for me too, and I'm 73, so that age is no obstacle for this. In Manhattan is like perfect for the bicycle because it's relatively compact and relatively flat, unless you're going up to Columbia, in which
fair
case
enough,
you're
right?
Be
so okay, so there, you know, that's why I have a folding bike, right? So I bike across town to the one train in the morning, right? Fold it up, take the train up, so I arrive with my crisp button-down shirt, right? And at night, I bike home fast, sweat like a pig when I arrive, right? But yeah, that's my workout, right? And I, you know, save on gym membership and, you know, get places fast.
The flaw in this, or the obstacle to this now, I think, being more widespread, is if you want people to bike, if you want to be a biking city, you have to make it safe for people to bike.
Of course.
And that means you have to have proper bike infrastructure, which is why, what is it? Everyone in Amsterdam bikes of any age, it's like 80%. I'm making up numbers now, but they're close. Yeah. 80% of all trips in Amsterdam are taken on bicycles, regardless of the age of the person and regardless of the season.
Yeah, I know that like for Copenhagen, right? It's like, yes, it's 80%.
The two best bicycling cities. Yeah. And because you can do it safely. And when you get there, there's a place to leave your bike.
Yeah. Well, and because that's another, right? Where do people choose to live? Right? So, you know, New York City, 8 million New Yorkers, 20 million who sometimes call themselves New Yorkers, right? Well, 12 million of them live in single-family homes out in the burbs where, yes, you could, right? You bike to the train, you take the train into the city, and you bike, right? But of course, right, you also need to arrange your life that, yes, you can get everywhere without a car.
Yeah. Why not a city bike? Why the folding bike?
Well, it turns out Lance was doing steroids and not folding bikes for a reason, right? So there are better bikes available, but the folding bike is still a lot better than the city bike, a lot faster.
Yeah, that makes sense. Another piece of this is when you get there, you have to have a place to leave your bike. If unlike you, I don't use the folding bike. I just have a clunky hybrid I use to get around. And you have to have a place to lock your bike. So when I came over here, I sort of checked to do a rough count on how many bike racks the Historical Society has. My approximate figure is zero.
Yep.
they're none. There's not a bike rack here. That's not right. You want to encourage people to be clean and green when they come here. And all you have to do is call up DOT, and they'll put them in for free. It doesn't cost you anything.
Might take a few months, but yes.
Well, months is optimistic, I agree. But, you know, it's
but actually, okay, so a lot is happening, right? Just to be clear. So the current mayor of New York, right, promised to convert 25% of all streetscapes into pedestrian and bike zones, right? I mean, even the language is right, right? Opening those streets, open streets,
no, that's
right?
A good thing, yeah.
And yeah, right? Now, of course, I know there's now better and worse ways of implementing that. That's true. But yes, it takes a shift like that to, frankly, achieve the sort of the mode shift here in terms of transport.
So, I mean, it seems for all three of your person, place, and your thing, you're in the position of being a kind of paragon, a kind of pioneer, demonstrating other ways to live. That you're demonstrating through individualist actions what to me seem like problems that require community solutions. But
yes,
you're a front runner.
But
I'm not. This isn't
no,
a criticism.
No. So
like,
it takes all of the
you're
above,
showing
right?
Us the way.
Well, it's not okay. So, thank you, but no, right? So that's certainly not enough, right? Okay, so just to be clear, it may actually backfire, right? Because the real danger is that you basically say, oh, you know, I bike a lot, or I refuse the plastic bag at the checkout counter, right? And then you walk your purchase onto the plane or back to your SUV or something, right?
Yeah.
Or, right, sort of the, oh, solved climate change for the day because I bike to work, so now let me work for my day job at that coal company, right? Doing obviously more harm with my day job than with the 10-minute bike commute.
Well, and is there also the sort of moral danger of you cease, if you find an individualist solution, you cease to be a constituency for societal change?
Sort of, right? Frankly, the real danger is, right, people look at me and say, okay, sorry, but I have no interest in looking like that particular nerd. So, you know, bigger car it is.
You're a good-looking guy. You don't have to take this from people.
Face for radio.
This episode of Person, Place, Thing was produced with the New York Historical Society's Climate Cafe and the Marlene Meyerson JCC Manhattan and distributed by WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The musician is Mamie Minch. Will Salwin is the recording engineer. Matt Temkin is the editor. Susan Packard is the associate producer. We had additional help from Russell Shorto. I'm Randy Cohen.